Welcome to the debate. You know, when we talk about rescue, say, like a rescue at sea, there is this this inherent assumption we have about the person in the water.
Right. Yeah, the victim.
Exactly. If someone falls overboard in a storm, we immediately picture them, you know, thrashing around, waving their arms, fighting the current.
Trying to stay afloat.
Yeah. And when the rescuer on the ship throws a life preserver, the victim has to, well, reach out and grab it. The rescuer provides the absolute singular means of salvation.
Mm-hmm.
But the victim still has to provide the exertion, right, to actually hold on.
It is a deeply cooperative image. And I think we naturally gravitate toward that framework because it makes sense to our daily human experience. You know, it preserves human agency.
Right. It feels intuitive to us.
Exactly. But I always ask people to step into the actual medical reality of drowning.
Okay.
What if the person in the water isn't thrashing? What if they have been submerged for, say, 10 minutes, their lungs are filled with water, and they are, for all intents and purposes, completely dead?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that changes the picture.
Right? In that specific scenario, tossing a life preserver to them is completely absurd. The rescuer has to dive in, physically pull the lifeless body out of the water, and artificially breathe life back into their lungs.
Before they can even, like, open their eyes?
Exactly. Before they are even capable of opening their eyes, let alone grabbing a rope.
And right there, just by looking at how we visualize a rescue, we have laid out the exact tension of our discussion today. This discourse emerges directly from the theological text, Works versus Effort.
Which is such a fascinating text.
It really is. It highlights this this profound linguistic and, well, theological collision in the Christian tradition. In short, the community has rightly developed an allergy to the concept of works.
Absolutely.
But in discarding the concept of works, there is a very real danger of accidentally discarding human agency altogether. We can end up with a theology where humans are totally passive.
Which leads us to the core question.
Right. So the central question of this debate is whether the exertion of the human will, what the source text categorizes specifically as effort, is a requirement for those seeking salvation.
And we approach this from two entirely different theological frameworks. I am representing the monogist perspective here.
The reform side.
Yes, arguing that because humans are spiritually dead, God entirely and unilaterally authors regeneration, which renders human effort as a prerequisite for salvation basically a theological illusion.
And I am representing the synergist perspective. I'll be arguing that human effort is a biblically required active participation in the covenantal relationship of salvation.
So we're really on opposite ends of the spectrum here.
We definitely are. Now, before we get into the mechanisms of how this actually plays out in the human soul, we need to explicitly define our terms based on the source text.
Yeah, or we'll just be talking past each other.
Exactly. When we talk about works, we are talking about actions performed to merit, purchase, or, you know, earn God's favor. It is entirely transactional.
It implies God is put in your debt because of your good behavior.
Right.
Which is the concept explicitly condemned in Ephesians 2:8-9. We are saved by grace, not by works, so that no one can boast.
Correct. But in contrast, the text defines effort not as earning, but as the active participation, the yielding, and the relational response of the human will to God.
So it's qualitative.
Yes. It is the kind of exertion commanded in scriptures like Philippians 2:12, where believers are told to actively work out their salvation. Dallas Willard, in his book, The Great Omission, laid out this framework brilliantly.
I love that quote. It's so good. He wrote, "Grace is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Earning is an attitude. Effort is an action."
That is a compelling argument. But have you considered that phrasing doesn't actually change the underlying reality of the human condition?
What do you mean? Well, distinguishing between earning as an attitude and effort as an action sounds intellectually satisfying, but it treats the issue as merely a vocabulary problem.
I don't think it's just vocabulary.
But you are building a framework on the assumption that the person in the water actually has the capacity to reach out and grab the life preserver. I come at it from a completely different way.
Okay, let's hear it.
If we look at the theological tradition I am defending, the monergist, or what many listeners might recognize as the Reformed or Calvinist approach, we have to take the biblical diagnosis of the human soul seriously.
Meaning you lean heavily on the concept of spiritual death.
Yes. In Ephesians 2:1, Paul's language is devastatingly clear. He writes that humans are dead in their trespasses.
Right.
He doesn't say humans are sick. He doesn't say they are drowning but still thrashing. He says they are dead.
Okay, but...
A dead person cannot exert the mental, emotional, or spiritual effort to ask for a life preserver. While Willard's effort sounds beautifully relational, it projects a capacity onto the human will that a fallen human simply does not possess.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. When Paul uses the word dead in Ephesians 2, he is using a metaphor for spiritual separation from God.
A very strong metaphor.
Sure, but it's not describing a physiological state of absolute inanimate paralysis. We have to be careful not to take a metaphor and push it past its intended boundary.
I'm not pushing it. I'm just reading it.
But if we treat dead in sin as absolute paralysis, we run into massive contradictions with how the Bible actually commands humans to behave.
I'm not sure it is a contradiction at all. I think it's just an uncomfortable diagnosis that we naturally want to soften.
Well, let's look at the nature of those commands and see how they function practically. Let's look at Matthew 7:7.
Okay.
Jesus explicitly says, "Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you."
A classic passage.
Right. But in the original Greek grammar, those aren't just one-time suggestions. They are present active imperatives.
Meaning continuous action.
Exactly. They literally translate to a command for continuous intentional effort. Keep asking, keep seeking, keep knocking.
Right.
Now, hold on. Let me make sure I'm following you here. If you are saying someone is completely dead and unable to even want the life preserver, how do they suddenly want to seek?
Well, that's where...
Let me just finish the thought. If God unilaterally regenerates the heart without our active participation, if he breathes life into the dead body before the person even wants it, aren't these continuous commands reduced to divine puppetry?
Divine puppetry? How do you mean?
I mean, it is like a parent walking up to a toddler, physically moving the toddler's jaw up and down to form the word please, and then praising the toddler for asking so politely.
That's a bit reductive.
But it empties the command to seek of any real meaning. Why would Jesus command continuous, exhausting human effort if the effort is just a pre-programmed, guaranteed response from a soul that God has already unilaterally resurrected?
Okay, we have to be careful not to reduce God's sovereign regeneration to mechanical puppetry. The Reformed view doesn't argue that the asking is fake.
It sure sounds fake.
No, the person is genuinely asking. They are genuinely seeking, and they are genuinely knocking. Their will is fully engaged.
Okay.
But we have to look at the causality of that seeking. How did it start? Charles Spurgeon famously noted, "If a man seeks God, it is only because God has already found him."
So you are saying the seeking is a real exertion of effort, but it is purely secondary.
Exactly. It is the fruit of God's prior saving work, not the prerequisite effort to obtain it. Let's look at the mechanism of how this works. Think of Lazarus in the tomb.
All right.
Jesus commands a literal dead man to come out. Now, a dead man cannot exert the effort to stand up.
Obviously not.
But the command of Christ, empowered by the Spirit, actually provides the ability to obey. Lazarus really walked out of that tomb. It wasn't puppetry. His physical muscles were contracting. His legs were moving. He was exerting immense effort to walk out of the dark.
But he was already alive when he did that.
Yes. His effort to walk was entirely downstream of the miracle of life that had just been unilaterally granted to him.
I see.
The monergist argues that human effort is absolutely real, but it is authored entirely by God. God gives the new heart first, and that new heart naturally beats.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning.
Why not? It solves the tension perfectly.
Because it creates a system where human responsibility is ultimately a mirage, even if you dress it up as organic fruit. If the command to come out is what mechanically grants the ability to come out, we are left with a terrifying question.
Which is?
Why doesn't everyone come out? If God alone provides the resurrection that causes the seeking, then the only reason someone doesn't seek God is because God chose not to resurrect them.
Which is the classic objection to Reformed theology. It brings us to the profound mystery of God's sovereignty and election.
But it's an objection that the synergist framework actually resolves through the mechanism of prevenient grace.
Ah, here we go.
If you're listening to this and wondering how someone can be spiritually dead but still make a choice to seek God, prevenient grace is the bridge. It literally means grace that goes before.
And how does that mechanism function without violating the spiritual death we see in Ephesians?
Because it acknowledges the fallen state, but elevates the power of grace to intervene. Synergism, which comes from the Greek roots for working together, agrees that a person left entirely to themselves in spiritual death cannot save themselves.
Okay, so we agree on total depravity.
Up to a point. We argue that God's grace flows out to all people, not just a select few. This prevenient grace acts upon the soul, freeing the human will just enough from the absolute bondage of sin to make a genuine, dignified choice possible.
So grace restores a sort of baseline capacity to choose.
Yes. Think of it like a medical scenario. A patient is in a coma, completely unresponsive.
Sticking with the medical metaphors, I say.
They work. So the doctor administers a powerful, targeted stimulant that wakes the patient up just enough so they are conscious and aware of their lethal condition.
Okay.
At that moment, the patient hasn't cured themselves, but they are now awake enough to sign the consent form for the life-saving surgery.
Right.
God provides the awakening grace, but the individual must still exert the internal effort to sign the form, to accept, to believe, and to repent.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why prevenient grace is so heavily contested and, frankly, why it falls apart when you look closely at the mechanics.
Go ahead.
It functions as a philosophical bridge constructed to solve a tension, but it elevates grace only up to the 99-yard line.
It elevates grace to the point of preserving human free will.
But look at the logical conclusion. Let's follow your coma analogy.
Okay.
God gives this waking prevenient grace to two different people. Both wake up. One exerts the effort to sign the consent form, and the other refuses.
What actually makes the difference between the two?
Their free choice.
But if the grace given to both was identical, then the distinguishing factor in salvation is the human being. The person who signed the form must be inherently wiser, more humble, or more spiritually attuned than the person who didn't.
Not necessarily inherently better, but willing to yield.
But yielding is an action. And if your ultimate salvation hinges on your final 1% of effort, then you fundamentally have something to boast about.
I wouldn't call yielding boasting.
You can stand in heaven and say, God provided the surgery, but I was smart enough to sign the consent form, unlike the guy next to me. That violates the very core of Ephesians 2, which explicitly states salvation is designed so that no one can boast.
I see where you're going with that.
The monergist view insists that God doesn't just partially wake the patient up and wait for their signature. He performs the surgery. He resurrects the dead soul entirely.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently because I don't believe the exertion of effort to receive a gift constitutes boasting. Let's go back to our drowning man.
Back in the water.
Back in the water. A drowning man who reaches out to grasp a rope thrown by the Coast Guard doesn't stand on the deck of the rescue ship and boast to the other passengers about his incredible world-class gripping strength.
Well, no.
The idea is absurd. He boasts about the rescuer who threw the rope. The effort of belief is simply the mechanism of reception. It's empty hands taking hold of something they didn't earn.
But the Reformed theologian would argue that even the ability to open the hands is a gift from God.
Yes, and I would argue that making grace entirely unilateral, where God essentially forces the hands open, defines away the nature of love. A forced love isn't love at all. It's programming.
That's a strong word.
If God flips a switch in my soul so that I have no choice but to seek him, then my seeking is mechanically guaranteed. It loses its relational value. Prevenient grace preserves the dignity of the human being as a creature made in God's image, capable of saying no to the life preserver.
I hear the appeal of that, truly.
And Jesus explicitly defines this internal yielding, this choice, as a type of exertion.
Wait, where does he define it that way?
In John 6:28-29. The crowd comes to Jesus and they are trapped in that transactional mindset we defined at the beginning. They ask him, "What must we do to the works God requires?"
Right, they want the checklist.
Exactly. They want a checklist to earn their way in. And Jesus completely redefines the paradigm. He says, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." He takes the physical, transactional deed they wanted to perform and transforms it into the internal effort of belief and trust. That internal effort, that belief, is the human requirement. It is an exertion of the will.
And I would push back by pointing out that right after Jesus says that in John 6, just a few verses later, he says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws them."
Yes, he does say that.
He bookends the requirement of belief with the reality of God's unilateral drawing power. This is exactly why this debate has endured for centuries.
We are wrestling with who ultimately holds the key.
Exactly. Is it the human will enabled and wooed by grace? Or is it God's sovereign, unstoppable action that takes a heart of stone and turns it into a heart of flesh without waiting for permission?
Which brings us to the profound paradox that both of our traditions have to grapple with when we try to reconcile these texts. We aren't just throwing abstract philosophical concepts at each other.
No, we are trying to faithfully interpret source material that seems to hold these two opposing ideas in absolute, blinding tension.
I agree. And there is no text in the New Testament that captures that tension better than Philippians 2:12-13.
Oh, absolutely.
It is the perfect crucible for everything we've been discussing regarding works, effort, and grace.
Let's look at the actual mechanism of that passage.
Go for it. I believe the first half is the ultimate validation of necessary human effort. Paul writes, "Continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling." Notice the exact phrasing.
Work out, yeah.
He does not say work for your salvation. If you work for it, you are back to transactional works, which we both agree is an ancient error. If you're wondering what theologians mean when they throw around a word like Pelagianism, it's simply that rejected idea that humans can earn heaven like a Wade by working for it.
Right, earning is completely off the table. Nobody wants to slide back into that.
Exactly. But Paul says work out. The Greek grammar here suggests bringing something to completion or manifesting it in reality. This implies an active, exhausting, deliberate exertion of the human will.
It's a heavy command.
It really is. It is a command to put your shoulder to the plow. It validates Willard's assertion that effort is an action inherently required of the believer. It is the synergist rallying cry. You have a role to play.
And as a monergist, I read that text and say, absolutely, the effort is there. The sweat on the brow is real.
But
I cannot stop reading halfway through the thought. I immediately have to read the very next sentence, which completes the thought and grounds the causality of that sweat.
The "for it is God" part.
Yes. After telling them to work it out, Paul continues, "For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose."
So the internal drive is provided by God.
Exactly the opposite of a standalone human effort. Yes, you are commanded to exert effort with fear and trembling. But the very desire to do so, the will and the energy to execute it, the act are entirely the foundational work of God inside you. It validates that God is the primary unilateral author of all saving action. When you work it out, you are merely manifesting what God has already sovereignly worked in.
It is a remarkable synthesis. What we find when we look closely at this source material is that there are profound points of convergence between our perspectives, despite the massive theological divide on the how and the why.
We do agree on the basics.
Both the synergist and the monergist absolutely reject works righteousness. We both agree that you cannot earn, purchase, or merit your way into God's favor.
We do, and I'll add a point of practical convergence. Even though strict reform theology debunks the idea of human effort as a prerequisite for salvation on a theological level, it is practically tolerated.
Even encouraged, right?
Yes, in the daily life of the Christian community, you will not find a Calvinist pastor telling a seeker, "Do absolutely nothing, exert no effort, just sit there on your hands and wait to see if you get resurrected."
That would be a terrible sermon.
It would.
No one advocates for a completely passive theology in practice. We still tell people to read their Bibles, to pray, to seek, and to exert effort.
Because practically, as Dallas Willard pointed out, grace is opposed to earning, not effort. If we step back and look at the scholarly consensus outside of strict monergism, we arrive at this beautiful, if somewhat mind-bending, formulation.
Which is?
Salvation is 100% the work of God's grace, and yet it requires 100% active participation from the human being. The effort of the human will has to be actualized, even if that effort is simply the raw humility to sign the consent form or ask for help.
I deeply respect the beauty of that formulation, even though I maintain my stance. From my perspective, we can safely say it involves 100% human participation so long as we recognize that the human's 100% is entirely downstream of God's sovereign regeneration.
The evidence of life.
Exactly. The exertion of our will, our frantic reaching for the life preserver, is the beautiful evidence that God has already worked the miracle of life within us.
Examining this tension between prevenient grace and monergism, between the exertion of human effort and the mystery of divine sovereignty, doesn't necessarily solve the debate.
No, not at all.
In many ways, looking at the mechanisms of how grace operates only deepens the mystery. It forces us to marvel at a God who is entirely self-sufficient, yet intimately involves human beings in the exertion of a relationship.
It really does. And the source text offers so much more historical nuance on how different traditions have wrestled with these theological paradigms. There is a lot more to explore for anyone willing to dig into the material.
It leaves us looking back at the dark water. When the life preserver hits the surface and the hands reach out to grasp it, we are left to wonder, is this the desperate exertion of a drowning soul empowered by grace to make a choice?
Or is it the first miraculous reflex of a dead person who has just been unilaterally given a brand new heart?
That is a mystery worth contemplating. We will leave you to weigh the evidence and draw your own conclusions. Thanks for joining us on The Debate.